Good morning and welcome to Home Fires Radio Show. This morning we're going to talk about small presses. Small presses as in presses that print books. With me in the studio are Neil Davis, who is a volunteer manager of the University of Alaska Press that is going through another change, and we're going to discuss that. Larry Larrabee, who is the owner of Spirit Mountain Press, and Sally Yari, who is representing Fireweed and a new feminist press called Vanessa Press. I would like to just talk about small presses in general in their generic form. First, I was looking at my books this morning, and I realized that most of the small independent press books that I have are poetry books. And I think that a lot of poets have, in fact, been published by small independent presses rather than the big, huge presses. And there seem to be a lot of them. I have Full Count Press and Black Bug Press from somewhere in Paducah, Kentucky, and, you know, this and that. They just sort of spring up. Somebody want to talk about small presses? What do you need to do to start a small press?
Well, I could say something about the university press and scholarly presses. These presses, I think, in general, don't publish poetry. Certainly, the University of Alaska Press definitely does not. It restricts its publications to things, well, since we are in Alaska, dealing with the Alaska and the North Pacific Rim and the Arctic, they're generally, well, always scholarly works, but essentially no fiction, although we do have one book published several years ago that is a fictional account based on life in on St. Lawrence Island, and so that, I suppose, is an exception. But by and large, we are dealing only with the scholarly material, historical and factual, as it were, although that includes folklore, but we definitely are not involved in poetry or the general fiction or manuals or journals.
Well, since we are talking about a university press, let's start our conversation there. How long has the University of Alaska Press been in existence?
That's a little hard to say. I keep finding that it has been publishing books sooner than I thought. I thought it had been in existence for about 20 years, but there seem to be titles that go back to almost the beginning of the university. And the press has been an on-again, off-again thing. It has never really been an entity, an established entity with a budget or with personnel. It's been a part-time operation up till just the last few months, and now the press does have a one employee.
Lita King?
Yes.
A full-time employee?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And how many titles has it published altogether in its history?
I think around 20. There are about 10 in the last 20 years that are published independently by the press, and it has published books also in conjunction with other presses, particularly University of Washington or Arctic Institute of North America, but not many books. There have been three in the last couple of years. So we just got one yesterday, in fact, our newest one, and we'll have another one out probably another 3 or 4 months.
What is your newest one?
The one that is just out now is called Alaska Natives in American Law by David Case, who was here at the university in Fairbanks and is now with the law office in Anchorage.
How does the university press decide what it's going to publish?
We have an editorial board that's composed of faculty, primarily from faculty from the Fairbanks campus, Anchorage campus, and Juneau campus. And so decisions are made upon the recommendations of that editorial group.
So the University of Alaska Press that's here is really a statewide press?
Yes, that's correct.
How many books do you expect to publish now that you're sort of back in gear with a full-time person?
That's hard to say. We're definitely struggling. We don't have an assigned budget. So it depends on what funding we can come up with. Each book has to be considered on its own. And normally, scholarly presses are not money-making propositions. They're definitely subsidized. They must be subsidized. I suspect there's not a scholarly press in the country that really makes any money, because part of their purpose is to publish things that are not commercial.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, what is the philosophy of if you don't have a really refined philosophy here yet, what is the basic idea behind university presses in general to publish works that they think are worthwhile that can't find another publisher?
Yes, scholarly presses will often publish books that are not likely to be widely sought. An example is one that came out a couple of years ago from University of Alaska Press called Documenting Alaska's History. And this is a book that lists what historical materials are available in the federal archives. And that's not the sort of thing that very many people are going to be interested in. It's and yet it's a service to historians and others interested in Alaska mm-hmm. materials.
Mm-hmm. So there's a very interested audience, but very small, so small that it really doesn't have any chance of being an economic base that would put that book in the black.
Yes, so that particular one, and I think a scholarly press will probably end up at least half the books that it publishes would be in that category. Of course, it would like to be able to make money. It'd be nice if you had a title once in a while that was profitable to help pay for the ones that there's no hope of making any money on.
In fact, some university presses do occasionally get a quote-unquote bestseller.
Yes, certainly do.
I went to the University of Illinois, and we had a professor there, Oscar Lewis, and he wrote The Children of Sanchez and so on and so forth, and originally, I believe, was published by the University of Illinois Press, I think was picked up, because university presses don't have the distribution mechanisms that the bigger presses
have. This has definitely been our problem here at the University of Alaska Press. There has never been any distribution system at all. We have a warehouse full of books dating back for many years. And that our first employee that we have now is we're calling marketing manager. This is Lita Kay, and she is really pushing on the marketing end. That's the thing that we've got to give priority to at this stage.
So presumably there are some people out there who'd like to read these books if they knew they existed and knew how to get them.
Yes, we find more people aren't even aware that the University Press exists. So.
Well, now our listening audience is aware that it exists. Are you allowed, given the, I don't know, the limitations of a university press to sell in bookstores? Is that one of the things you aren't allowed to do, or can you do that?
No, we do sell in bookstores, and our main advertising is by mail, so we send out flyers to people that we think would be interested in particular titles, and also advertising the full list. We get quite a few, I suppose half of the books that are sold are by mail, and then the other half would be to book distributors or directly to bookstores.
The university presses advertise in scholarly journals or other university publications that creates a sort of network?
There is such a network, and that's normally done. As yet, the University of Alaska Press doesn't really quite qualify to belong to the Association of University Presses because we're not so far putting out enough titles. And we don't really have an adequate structure yet, but that would be a way that a university press would normally do. We haven't been doing it yet.
Mm-hmm. Because you're just beginning again. Is that now, Larry, with your Spirit Mountain Press, do you have anything in common with what we've just discussed about this revived university press, or is it totally, totally different? You've owned Spirit Mountain for 6 years. What was your motivation for starting it? Did you start it, or did you buy it from someone?
No, I started it.
Okay.
Excuse me. My motivation for starting Spirit Mountain Press was a way to self-publish, basically.
You're a writer?
Yes, I am.
Of fiction, poetry?
Poetry.
Poetry.
Primarily, although recently I've been writing some prose.
Mm-hmm.
To answer your first question, I think the one thing that I have in common, Spirit Mountain might have in common with the University Press and possibly many small presses, is that problem of distribution. That's a real major problem. Places like Fairbanks News Agency, the places that are general distribution centers for areas such as Fairbanks, really don't have the time or the staff to promote small presses. They're primarily publishing books that aren't big sellers, that aren't bestsellers, that don't turn fast enough. And so there's really not the profit margin, I think, for mm-hmm. them to take that on. And so consequently, a press like myself with 1, 2, 6, 8, 10 titles in print has to go around and plug to the local bookstores. And of course, for the booksellers, they're looking for books that are going to turn, and it's easier for them to buy, you know, to sit down and talk with a representative that can come in with 10 or 20 or 50 titles and order all at once than to spend all day long, you know, talking with the people from small presses that have only, like I say, 1, 2, 6 titles, something like that.
Mm-hmm. What is your reaction to my first statement that a lot of small presses pretty much exclusively publish poetry?
Well, I'm not sure if that's entirely accurate, although that's certainly true that small presses have a reputation for publishing primarily poetry. And I think that in part the reason for that is that the larger houses aren't interested in poetry for the same reasons that the distribution people aren't interested in poetry, and that's that it doesn't, you know, it's not a real hot seller. I can't offhand think of a single living, working poet today that makes a living from writing poetry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Perhaps there are some. I don't know of any.
Mm-hmm. What about Gary Snyder? Does he come close?
I think...
He teaches a lot.
That's right.
He does a lot of workshops around the country.
And he does a lot of workshops. He does lectures. He does readings. And I have no idea what else he may be involved mm-hmm. in. I would doubt seriously if he makes a living from his writing.
Even first-rate poets, Wallace Stevens, who is now deceased, but he worked as, well, he's famous because he worked in such a normal, quote-unquote, normal job as an insurance office for all his life. But, I mean, he certainly was acclaimed and recognized and in no way could make money on his poetry. The other thought, I know nothing about the technical aspects of printing, and I want to talk about that a little bit, and it has changed. The technology of printing has changed a lot. But it had occurred to me looking at those books this morning that it's easier to typeset a poetry book than it is to do an entire, say, 230-page novel that may be technically beyond the grasp of a small press, or is that not a problem anymore now that they don't set by hand?
Well, it's that's interesting. If type were being set by hand, certainly there are less characters to set in setting a book of poems. But the design concepts in setting a book of poetry, I think, are oftentimes more difficult than setting a book of straight text, where you have the same parameters to go with throughout the book. Whereas in poetry, you have the poet. Part of writing poetry is the visual image that it presents, and poets will write their poems with their lines ending in certain places, and they have real specific ideas about how they want that poem to visually appear.
So you're not only talking about the creative part of the design, but you're talking about the technical difficulty of setting up the page, that each page is totally different.
That's correct. A real good example of that is we worked with Vanessa Press on typesetting and layout for their recent publication of How the Quilt Maker Became a Dragon.
Mm-hmm. And there's even some italic setting, some different kinds of letters. What is the word? different sorts of type within a given, well, it's not even a given poem on a given page.
Well, with this particular publication, it's not only the poetry, but there are also graphics, and so there's the typography, there's the graphics, there's the design of the overall project. There's a lot more that goes into making a book, certainly, than just writing, you know, writing the book down and saying, well, here, publish this, you know, here's my book. You know, that's really just the beginning. You know, that, because then you get into just a whole nother world of publication, you know, and that's typography and design and paper selection and ink selection.
I'm aware that some of the small presses have gone back, excuse me, to some very old techniques because they make a really special quality book. They use papers of real, really complex manufacture, and they will use some of the old typesetting techniques and so on, so that the product itself, to hold a book, it's not simply the information that you're getting out of that book as you read it, but the pleasure of holding it, of feeling the paper, of the special visual quality of the ink. What is the press in Port Townsend?
Well, there's more than one.
There's
a couple that are more notable, and one is Gray Wolf, and the other is Copper Canyon Press.
Copper Canyon, that's what I was thinking of. They use some...
I did a workshop at Copper Canyon Press a couple of summers ago, and the in-house work that they do there, they do set all the type by hand, and the work is printed on hand-fed letter presses. And as far as I know, all of their work that's printed in-house now is limited editions. It's printed on 100% rag paper, or at least acid-neutral paper, so the books are going to last, which is not true of mass-produced books today. They're printed on very inexpensive papers, and again, it has to do with that that big dollar sign. You know, they have to turn the books, and it has to make a profit, et cetera, et cetera. And part of that is the cost of the paper.
So at Copper Canyon, they're really viewing the printing itself as part of the art. There's the writing, which is art, but then there's also the printing itself, which is an art.
Exactly. And I think that Tree Swenson, who is one of the owners of Copper Canyon Press, is considers herself an artist first rate in book design and in manufacturing. She said something to the effect, and I'm sure I'm not quoting this verbatim, but that her desire, her passion with Copper Canyon Press is to create the perfect book. That's her goal in life with Copper Canyon, is to create the perfect book.
Well, I've been to Copper Canyon because I have a friend who was a poet in the schools in that area, and it's a really pleasant space to be in that environment with those old presses and... So and it feels very good, and it's a revived art, I suppose, like, what do you call it, coopering, where they make the barrels for wine. That's an old classic medieval art that they're trying to keep alive, and I guess having some difficulty because, as you say, the bucks aren't there in terms of supporting it. How does Copper Canyon support itself?
Well, I do know that they receive some state and federal funding. They're located there in Fort Worden State Park, and I believe are under the watchful wing of Centrum Foundation, which is a nonprofit organization. So, I really don't know how their structure.
That's fairly typical of small presses. They need some benefactor or some foundation or some grants monies or.
Well, it's certainly helpful. It certainly is. You know, one of the reasons I think, other than the aesthetic values of printing with letter presses and hand setting type, is that it's affordable for a small press. A person can pick up a letter press and enough type to get started for probably $1,000. And to set up a press with electronic typesetting and offset presses and camera and plate making equipment, you know, I can't imagine it being done for less than $15,000-$20,000, and that's just bare bones, and probably $50,000-$75,000 to get any kind of a setup at all.
What did you start with?
Oh, I'm not even sure I want to talk about it. We started out on a shoestring with a very small letter press and less than $1,000, believe it or not. And we made a deal with someone in the community to renovate a building for a year's free rent, so we didn't have that high overhead our first year. And we started out, Spirit Mountain started out sharing a space with a little paper that's no longer in existence here in Fairbanks, the Homespun North. And we shared an office with them for about 2 years, almost 2 years.
You're a writer, first and foremost? Is that where your primary passion is, or have you slowly been won over to the printing side of it?
That's an interesting question. Sally and I have been talking about that some recently. For the last year or 15, maybe 18 months, I've written almost nothing, and I've been working real hard at publishing and printing, and I've decided this year to make a New Year's resolution. I never make New Year's resolutions, but I've decided this year that I'm going to make a New Year's resolution to start writing again, that I feel somehow lost or vacant without it.
Mm-hmm. One of those cycles, you start a press so that you're writing will have an audience, and then the press takes over and the vehicle becomes the main thing, and then there's no time to write, which was the
exactly.
initial motivation. Sally.
Hi, Patty.
Hi. Let's talk a little bit about Fireweed and Vanessa. First, Fireweed, because Vanessa is a brand new feminist press, an imprint. Is that mm-hmm. correct? Of Fireweed. But let's talk about Fireweed. In what way does Fireweed differ from Larry's Spirit Mountain?
One of the main ways it differs is that it is nonprofit. We have a tax-exempt nonprofit status.
I didn't even ask Larry if he made a profit.
That's the plan.
It'll happen someday. That's one of the main things. The other thing is that Fireweed is a publishing house, and that is, we don't do any printing or typesetting in-house. We contract it all out. And Larry publishes and typesets and prints. We contract the typesetting out to Spirit Mountain. The printing is done by a number of people, mainly Michigan printers, such as Brom Brumfield and McNaughton and Gunn.
So, I didn't realize things are... You do part of it here, you set the type here, and then what do you send when you send it to an outside firm for printing?
You send a camera-ready manuscript.
The camera-ready manuscript, and there are houses that do printing for lots of small presses all over the country that are some that have better reputations than others. That's not true of Copper Canyon. They do everything there.
No, that's not true. Okay. They originally started out doing everything in-house, and now the only work they do in-house is their limited edition work.
So binderies, is that what they're... That's a whole...
Book manufacturers.
They're book manufacturers.
All, as far as I know, and I could be wrong, but as far as I know, all of Copper Canyon's trade publications, if you would, for lack of a better term, mass market publications, are sent to a book manufacturer for printing and bindery.
How many book manufacturers are there in the country?
I have to ask him that.
I mean, are there a lot? I don't care about a specific number, but I mean, are there 5 or are there 5,000? Or
I would guess there's maybe 20 fairly large book manufacturers in the country.
And so what the couple you named are mm-hmm. are book manufacturers that you're happy with? What basis do you, not raised eyebrows, not very happy?
Well, fortunately and unfortunately, one of the things that's appealing about them is that they're cheap, so that you can get a book printed outside for considerably cheaper than you can get it done in Alaska. And that's unfortunate in the sense that we would like to keep the money within the state, of course. But if you are on a budget, as everybody in this room seems to be, or have no money, sometimes you have no choice. And that's how we felt with the first Vanessa book, was that we didn't have many alternatives.
Mm-hmm. Are there book manufacturers in the state?
There are people in the state who specialize in printing books and who do a very good job of it. Dragon Press in Delta, for instance, is one person who's very good. Chris Braun there is a master printer, and he does excellent work. He did Joan Kopanen's book mm-hmm. on houses.
Building from Within.
Right, Building from Within.
But because of the just typical in-state costs, mm-hmm. that just inevitably, even with the adding the transportation in, it still is at a higher rate than if you send it out.
It is, unfortunately.
Okay. Almost double.
Almost double.
And in some cases, more than double.
It's pretty frightening.
Yeah, it's interesting that most of the presses that are winning the bids are in Michigan. This seems to be a big base, and it's not.
It's a big paper, big know, paper place. Ann Arbor's a big paper town.
I know many larger presses are having things printed there too, and it's just a matter that they can do. We've had rather good luck with a couple. One Thompson Shore won bids on 2 of our recent books, and been quite pleased with them.
So you send these things, all of these. If you're looking for a book manufacturer, you send things out for bid.
Yes,
we
do.
Is it? I haven't looked. There's a lot of information on the inside of a book. Does it say who the printing, who the book manufacturer is?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes.
So you can begin to get some idea of the product by looking at other books they've manufactured.
I think that's more common with small presses, that they will include information on typography and design and sometimes even the printer of the book, although that's not as common as the person who would maybe have designed or been involved with typography for the book.
So then part of it is word of mouth. You have good experience with one book manufacturer and you tell someone else. And
also they advertise.
Right. You know, where do they advertise?
Oh, in...
Are there trade papers in this?
Yes, there are. A small press journal is a real common place for advertising. Some of the journals such as West Coast Review of Books or the New York Review of Books.
What kind of things are in a small press journal?
Wonderful things.
Like?
Lots of articles on other presses' experiences mm-hmm. in the printing business and the publishing business. For instance, a couple issues back, there was an article on Crossing Press in New York and how they got started and the kinds of things they publish and how they specialize and they spun off into certain areas and their strategy for spinning off. They seem to be real good at timing, knowing when to move into a certain market. Let's see, what else? I just started subscribing to it, so Larry probably knows more than I do what's in it. But lots of helpful articles on strategies for marketing and promotion. NEA now has a promotional grant that you can apply for if you're a small press, and they'll do a lot of the promotion for you. And there was an article on that, and so that kind of thing.
What's coming very clear to me here so far in this discussion, so this is really a multifaceted undertaking, that there's the editorial considerations of deciding what kind of philosophy or what kind of writing that you're going to publish. I know that feminist presses, some of them just have a very definite political bent, and they're really trying to get across their political point. and then some, of course, are literary, and then they have a certain, I guess, stable of writers that they like to print. So after you get past the choosing what books you're going to publish, then there are all the technical considerations, and obviously there are just a very long list of multiple choices of the ways you can go. And then, of course, then the whole marketing strategies, which are probably ultimately what either put you under or put you in the black or at a break-even position. At any rate, even if you were fully endowed, I would think that you'd want people to read. You aren't going to all this trouble if you don't have a strong desire to have people read what you're publishing, right?
That's real true. You know, the marketing and distribution is just so critical, and it's like what was said earlier about having a whole warehouse full of books. What good is having all these books in print if no one is ever able to find them, to be able to buy them, to be able to look at them?
Okay, I sort of trailed off. I do want to pick up that thread and go back to Fireweed. Mm-hmm. It was organized as a nonprofit by
Pat Monahan and someone in Juneau whose name I've now forgotten. It's been incorporated since, I think, 1976, but has only more recently just started publishing. I think they published some broadsides or a calendar, you know, several years back.
And do you know what their original organizing motivation was?
I honestly don't.
Okay. So they printed a few things, but they are incorporated as a nonprofit.
Right.
And what are some Fireweed titles?
Oh, okay. let's see. The most recent title is The Compass Inside Ourselves, which was written by Nancy Lord. And it was part of a grant given by the Alaska State Council on the Arts to Fireweed to select a short story contest winner. And what we did, what Fireweed did, was solicit manuscripts from throughout the state. And then there was a three-person committee, Gene Anderson, Pat Monahan, and Roland Wilbert, who did an original screening. And then they were sent to Stanley Elkin, who's a very well-known short story writer, and he did the final selection of Nancy's book. Prior to that, Fireweed published Hunger and Dreams, which is a really well-known women's anthology. And presently, Fireweed has in the works a men's anthology, which is being edited by Larry Larrabee and Roland Wilbert.
And you solicited stories for that statewide?
That's correct. And not only statewide, but also nationwide.
And the desire then was to, I heard some of the publicity on that, was to have stories written by men, but not necessarily limited to the so-called manly arts. We have a lot of Alaskan literature based on bear hunting and sort of adventure story, kind of wilderness experience things, and you were trying to get something a little different.
That's right. We were looking for men obviously have more experiences than bear hunting and wrestling and
hopefully
and that kind of thing. And there's been some marvelous literature written about what men feel and do and think that don't necessarily fall into that stereotyped category.
Macho man.
That's right. And we received, in fact, part of the problem, and it is a problem, the book is long overdue coming out. Part of the problem for that has been that we received just an incredible amount of manuscripts that we've, and good, not only manuscripts, but many, many good manuscripts, both the prose and poetry. And I think we're now finally down to the final selection phase.
So you really aren't there. I mean, you haven't decided finally what you're going to put in that.
We're about 99% there at this point. I think the biggest consideration now is pages. You know, obviously it can only be so many pages because of budget and other constraints, and we have the pieces that we would like to use, but we may have to eliminate some pieces due to length of the volume.
Space considerations.
Yeah.
How long do you expect it will take you from the time that those editorial kinds of considerations are finished? How long will the actual mechanical part of getting this book completed be?
This particular book or a book in general?
A book in general. It's okay.
Well, that's Vanessa Press's first volume, I think, is an interesting example of that because everyone wanted it to be out for this tour that happened in, or a reading, I believe, in June.
It's a premiere, musical premiere.
In Juneau, and so there was a very tight time constraint, and Sally could probably answer the...
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Yeah, I think we did it faster than, A, you should do it if you want to survive mentally, and B, faster than it probably normally happens. But from the editing stage, and that is we took some of the book and edited it down a little bit, to the final product stage was just about 3 months, maybe 2.5 months.
But all of you consider that kind of record time?
It's
Neil saying
fast.
Yes.
It's
we're more like a year.
Yeah, generally. But we had, as Larry said, we had this musical premiere of the book, which was coming up in Juneau on December 1st. And so in many ways it was good because it gave us a very strict deadline that we wanted
incentive.
To adhere to. And as it was, and I'm almost embarrassed to admit this, but I will, the book arrived in Juneau the day before the premiere at 1:30 in the afternoon. And it was pins and needles all the way. We were checking on it. We knew when it left Michigan. We knew when it was in Seattle and when it was on its way to Juneau. But it was
very
a real
exciting business you're in.
It's a very exciting
heart
business.
Stopping.
It sort of keeps you on pins and needles all the time, to say the least. But anyway, I don't know if it's the first book that I've ever been involved in publishing, so my guess is it's not a normal time period.
The other side of that coin is a series that we're working on with the Yukon Koyukuk School District, a series of biographies, and they come to us in manuscript form from Kurt Madison and Yvonne Yarber do the interviewing and the photos and put the manuscript together, and they send the manuscript to us. We do the typesetting. We send the galleys back to them. They live in Manly Hot Springs. We send the galleys back to them. They proofread them. They then give them to an independent proofreader. They send them back to us for corrections. We make corrections, send them back to them.
Mm.
They approve those corrections. We then do the layout. We proof the layout. We send it to them back in Manly. They proof it another time. They send it back to Fairbanks. We make any corrections that may be made at that point. We send them then off to Michigan for silver prints, which is like a pre-press proofing. Michigan then sends them back to us. We make any corrections that we may find at that point, send them back to Manly again for another proofing. They come back to us. We make any further corrections and or changes, and there are always changes. They then go back to Michigan for more silver prints. They come back to us. They go back to Manly. They come back to us again. They finally go out to Michigan. That whole process takes a year easy.
Depending on how efficient the post office is,
even using express mail, it's just incredible the amount of time that it takes.
Do you keep copies of all these various stages so that, have you ever lost anything
we
critical in the mail?
We keep copies and copies and copies.
Copies of the copies.
That's right.
You leave nothing to chance. That brings me to another question, and that is when we talk about big publishing houses, they have, at least in the old days, one of the critical things that allowed certain book publishers to have success was that they had very good editors who had very good taste, if you will, or at least an understanding of what the reading public wanted. And some famous editors like Perkins, which I guess there may not be very many around of his quality anymore. They've just been doing some attention has been paid in the press because it's his 100th anniversary of his birth, or I don't remember exactly. But what does a university press or a small press do that's equivalent to that in terms of a raw manuscript? I mean, do you have an editor, or Neil, do you, or do you just take the raw manuscript and say, okay, it's going to...
Well, it's because of the editorial capability that I got involved with the university press. My involvement started because I was writing a book on energy resources of Alaska, and there was a question of where I was going to publish it, and I decided to go with the University of Alaska because of the editorial people that are here, particularly Carla Helfrich and Kathy Morak were editors on that book.
They edit Northern Engineer.
Yes.
Which is a publication of...
Of the Geophysical Institute
and contains scientific articles of research being done here for our audience's sake.
This was really great as far as I was concerned. I was able to work with those people for a year. It took me 2 years to write the book, and then there was another year there of rewrite and working with them on an almost daily basis. And so it was really quite a great experience for me because both of them were much better, knew much more about editing and taught me a lot about writing, too. So that has been, I think, the critical thing here, that there is that capability. And by the way, you know, at least as far as the university press is concerned, that cost of bringing a manuscript from just the manuscript stage to camera ready to go out to the printer is far greater cost than the printing, probably by a factor of 3 or 4 times.
Because of the intensive staff hours?
Mm-hmm. All this editing and the layout work and preparation of typesetting does take a lot. And
if you had submitted your first manuscript to another publisher and let's say they had accepted it, you're presuming now that you wouldn't have had that kind of intensive editorial partnership?
I think not. It would have been, I would send a manuscript off and they would send it back and I would rewrite and probably it would go in steps like that, perhaps several times, depending on how good a job I was doing as a writer.
But you would have been more on your own.
They had. But here it was really great being able to work with these people day by day. I would, they would edit and make suggestions, and I could rewrite and come right back. And we went through probably 3 or 4 versions on all of the work. So, and I don't think it'd be possible to do that.
And it's a much more readable, accessible product as a result?
Yeah, they definitely made their imprint on the book.
I want to ask you, in terms of Vanessa Press, I know that the editorial board's been working really hard in reading a lot of manuscripts. How many manuscripts have you read in the last year, let's say?
Since May, we've probably read nearly 20 manuscripts. Just since May. The first batch, there was about 10 in, and the second batch, there were 8 or 9. So we are a 5-person editorial board, which
volunteer.
Does more than just all volunteer. We're also promoters, distributors, et cetera, et cetera. We go through a pretty interesting process with our manuscripts, if I could just tell you about it.
Mm-hmm.
We have a scale with about 8 or 9 criteria. From everything to feminist appropriateness to characteristic style that we use. And when we read a manuscript, we individually rate that manuscript based on that criteria. Then we come together once a week and we review a manuscript and we look at it from that objective criteria point of view, and then we look at it from a subjective point of view. And in that subjectivity, we consider things like, do we like it personally? Do we think that it's saying something to women and to men in the state of Alaska? Is it something that's marketable? You know, a very basic question that we always have to answer. And then at the end of the review process, we come back together again and we use all the criteria to make a decision. And it's never easy.
Then did you do a lot of editing on Nickerson's?
We did some editing. I wouldn't say we did a lot. I would say we did we did some.
So that would vary depending on the manuscript you selected.
Definitely.
And
definitely.
Some people obviously need a lot more editing than others. That famous story of Tom Wolfe arriving with his manuscript of Look Homeward, Angel, and I don't know how many pounds it was or how high it was, but it was an enormous thing. And Perkins, in fact, did do considerable editing. And so I guess that varies writer to writer, editor to editor.
Sure. Some things that you receive are just in a more refined state, and part of that depends on the writer and where they are in the writing and how much polish they want to take to it. And sometimes you get things that are very unpolished but have lots and lots of potential.
Power and real appeal.
Yes, incredibly so. And that's the kind of person you don't want to discourage at all. You want to encourage them as much as possible.
Well, Neil, you indicated, and I know you're a good writer, but you indicated that it's a real partnership and that you can really benefit from some judicious editing.
Oh, yeah. I really feel good about my experience with this. I've been writing scientific stuff for 20, 30 years, and but my writing ability over the course of this book has improved, I'm sure, 100%. I go back and look at some of the first draft material that I did in the very beginning of the project, and it's pretty bad. And I can recognize that now, and I certainly didn't then. So I feel that I really learned a great deal, and it is a very nice partnership. It's great for an author to be in that situation. I suspect you don't get that chance often enough.
You are a scientist and an embracer of appropriate technology. I know that you wrote this book on a word processor. In what way does that help the editing process? I mean, has that made it really a lot easier than retyping every new version of it?
Totally? Yes. Unfortunately, the material that I was putting out was not in a form coming out of my word processor. It was not possible to take that machine readable material and put it into the typesetting equipment. So it all had to be retyped. It's unfortunate to have to do that. But it did help a lot. But then once we got we were doing still editing on typeset material too. So once the changes got into that, and that was machine readable too. That is, we could go in and change quite easily, just as though we're in a word processor. But soon we got to the point where I couldn't use a word processor anymore. We were just working on the typeset material.
So I see. Because of the form it was in.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I could no longer use my equipment on it.
Right. Not because of frustration.
No.
That it would
right.
be easier to do it with a pencil. No, just because of the form it was in,
yes.
ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
How much editing do you do, Larry? I mean, you're a writer. You're publishing.
Actually, I do... for the books that we have in print now, very little editing. The biggest in-print work that we have going right now is the Yukon Koyukuk biography series. And they come to us edited by Kurt Madison and Yvonne Yarber. And what they do is taped interviews with the biographies and stay as close as possible to that interview.
It's an oral history.
It is.
Which we talked about a few weeks ago. Okay, so obviously there's great, really great variety in that process too. Some of the things that you are publishing through Spirit Mountain are really finished manuscripts that someone else has done the editing, and you're not soliciting those manuscripts. They are seeking you out as a publisher.
That's correct. And much of our work, in fact, has to do with typesetting and layout and design as opposed to straight publishing.
So this back and forth that you're involved with is is for correction of galleys to all of this complex...
That's correct.
...mailing back and forth that you were describing before is to make sure that the final printed product will be without errors.
That's correct. And as opposed to the University Press and Vanessa Press, we have printing and some bindery equipment at Spirit Mountain and actually do some of our own printing and bindery there.
I've noticed a tremendous, I don't know whether it's the glue or what is going on. I have read several books lately that are just literally by the end of it falling apart in my hand. And I'm not, I suppose, the most gentle person with books. They tend to sort of pile around my bed and get things put on them, but...
Apparently, the others here probably know much more about this than I, but this is a problem in a dry, cold climate. On the book Alaska Science Nuggets, published by the Geophysical Institute, we spent an extra $1,000 in binding that to put on a special binding and glue so that that book can be folded open at any point and put on a copying machine and it won't break. But I suppose that unless that's done, and probably many presses don't spend that money, then they are going to break here in this climate.
Oh, that's curious. It never occurred to me that it was our environment that might be contributing to it. I just based it on modern tackiness.
Well, it's both. It's yeah. both. The most common by far bindery method for mass market publications today is what they call, quote, perfect binding, unquote. And it is very far from perfect. And basically all it is much like the tablet you used in grade school, where it's glued at the top and a cover's wrapped around it. And that's basically what perfect binding is. And it doesn't hold up in our climate. And to the best of my knowledge, they don't have a glue that that really does hold up. As opposed to certainly many of the small presses will use what's called a sew-and-wrap, even for a paper cover. And that's that the signatures are actually sewn into the book and then glued in the back. And it's possible that that will come apart also, because it is a glue, but it's not where every single page is glued in. They're actually sewn into the book.
Some of those very old books, Merritt has a library that consists of a lot of old books from his family. And they're wonderful just as things to hold. And, you know, it's obvious that the binding is done very carefully. And I don't know how much handwork was involved in a book that was published 100 years ago or 150 years ago, but obviously a lot more than is involved in our books. There's another thing that's interesting to me in reading a variety of books, why some books are so difficult to read. I mean, you know, when you have a whole choice of print, and there are some prints that are quite easy to read, I've also had books that I've read recently that the paper seems to be transparent, so you can almost see the next page through it, and that the printing is very, very difficult. I mean, is that a decision that you have to make as a publisher, what kind of type you're going to use, what kind of...
I think it's an area where there's a... It has to do, I think, a lot with the world we live in today, where there isn't a conscientiousness between the writer and the publisher and the printer, and so those kinds of things happen. And I think they're one of the things that small presses have going for them is that many small presses have a conscientiousness of typography and design and a knowledge of paper and bindery. And that's not necessarily evident in some of the, in fact, most of the larger presses. And books are manufactured to move.
Mm-hmm. We have a cliche or idiom that says you shouldn't judge a book by its cover. But in fact, it's clear from the marketing that's being done in the supermarkets and so on that we do judge a book by its cover. And the appeal of a book, I mean, you don't just choose a book on the author and on recommendation of friends or reading reviews, but also we do make some judgments on how a book looks.
Mm-hmm. Sure. When I was in Juneau a couple weeks ago, a woman was telling me that she has a book on small publishing, small presses or self-publishing or something, and they've done a lot of market research and found that people spend 15 seconds looking at the back cover of a book and 8 seconds looking at the front of the cover. So you get some feel for where that, you know, for where people look. I was at a small press book fair called Bumbershoot in Seattle, and I found that people would come along and they had never heard of any of our books, so and they didn't know what they were about. And they would pick them up and they would either look at the back cover or they would look inside. And I couldn't tell if they were looking for credits or what exactly they were looking for in those first few pages, maybe just an introduction or some feel for the book.
By looking at the back, we're looking for some reviews, some confirmation that people we know like this book?
That's part of it. A lot of books have a synopsis on the back of the book, or they'll have credits, or they'll have information about the writer, a number of things that I think we all look for as prospective readers.
It's interesting that, that analysis would include more time on the back than on the...
Well, there isn't much to look at on the front. I mean, you sort of get a graphic idea.
But it needs to attract your attention.
Right. Oh, that's very important. Sure.
Was it hard for you, Neil, to decide how the front of your book should be, the back?
Yes, we spent quite a bit of time thinking about that, particularly on the dust jacket. The philosophy we used was heard something somewhere that if you want to sell cereal, you put it in red and yellow. And so we have red and yellow on the dust jacket of this book is an attractive to attract attention, and tried to design the book so that it would stand out on the bookshelf. And, obviously, this is very important. It's interesting to have people glance at a row of books and see which ones they'll pick out. And sometimes it's the size of the lettering or the color.
Yeah, it was interesting. The World According to Garp, they published it in multi-colors, sort of a metallic thing in paperback, and marketed it in the bookstores. Some were red, some green, some silver. And that was really eye-catching, that there would be the World According to Garp in different colors. So it really does involve a variety of strategies. Before we run out of time, where are all your books available? If we've whetted everybody's appetite and have created a new awareness of small presses, and certainly the fact that we have several very alive and well presses in Alaska, where can people look at your books?
Let's see. Well, our books are one book, basically, on Why the Quiltmaker Became a Dragon. It's available at several places in Fairbanks, Spirit Mountain Press, Baker & Baker Booksellers, the Village Bookstore in Shoppers Forum.
Where is Spirit Mountain?
Spirit Mountain Press is at 558 Gaffney, right across the street from Sears and upstairs from Fairbanks Drama Association's theater.
Good. And where are we going to be able to get University of Alaska books?
These are in local bookstores, particularly Baker & Baker, in the Village Bookstore, and Book Cache. They also are available by writing to the university. One can write to University of Alaska Press, and our address now is Signers Hall.
Great.
At the university.
Well, I found this very interesting. Obviously, it's a real complex field. You need to know a lot of things in order to publish a book. My guests have been Larry Larrabee, Neil Davis, Sally Yari, and we've been talking about small presses. This has been Home Fires Radio Show. Our executive producer is Carla Tonella, and I've been your host, Patty Kostelic. Have a good week.